Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery, leadership revolution, and life success. Learn something new from our mentoring conversation today.
There are several things that I hadn't thought of before until Nancy asked me two or three questions. And one threw me completely, which was about how my parents treated me and what impact that may have had on the way I brought up my kids. And that is something I hadn't really thought of. So there was some thought here that I was not anticipating, but I'm glad it happened.
Welcome, everybody, to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy. I'm lucky enough to have three podcast sponsors this week. Priscilla Vang owns Payroll Vault. It's a St. Paul franchise, and she helps people with payroll. And also, there's a lot of tax questions that we have this fall, and so she's available, and her information is at the end of this podcast. Our second podcast sponsor for this week is Ursula Menches, and she owns Sales Coach Now. She's got a sales camp. It's phenomenal. I've been through it. It's really helped me to understand my intentions behind developing relationships and through the sales process. And then thirdly, after you're done with all this series on the Pennsylvania Grand Jury Report and how they've got a playbook in play right now, concealing the truth, you will probably need a back rub. So go to Great Metropolitan Back Rub and see Annette Rondano. She would love to help you out and get you your kinks worked out of your shoulders. It's full clothing massage, so it's very comfortable if you've never had a massage before. All right, so welcome to the program, John Choi. He's Ramsey County Attorney, and he made history on January 3rd, 2011, when he was sworn in as the first Korean-American chief prosecutor in the country. Since taking office, John has become a state and national leader in the fight against sex trafficking. John's innovative approach to holding abusers accountable while working collaboratively with advocacy agencies to help victims has transformed the way government intervenes in domestic violence and sex trafficking situations. John is now determined to do the same for victims of sexual assault. He stepped up his leadership in this area 2 years ago by conducting a systems review of sexual assaults in Ramsey County to shine a light on the current system response and need for improvement. As a result, he worked with our city and county partners to develop trainings and immediately reallocate resources to enhance our capacity in investigations and advocacy so we can better support victims and hold perpetrators accountable. Oh, we need more of that. In addition, John has been a champion of engaging men to prevent violence against women and children, successfully advanced legislation to reunite families when it's in foster children's best interest, implemented new performance-based outcomes for juvenile diversion programs, developed the use of lethality assessment protocols, and GPS technology to keep domestic violence victims safe, created pre-charge diversion for adults, and he established a veterans court. Throughout his public tenure, John has been innovative in reforming and finding efficiencies in the criminal justice system. In his previous capacity as St. Paul City Attorney, John was recognized with the International Municipal Lawyers Association's top award for distinguished public service. Prior to his successful career in the public sector, John spent a decade in private practice, making partner in 6 years while focused on government relations, administrative law, municipal law, and civil litigation. John holds a bachelor's degree in psychology from Marquette University, a Juris Doctorate degree from Hamline University School of Law, and was a Humphrey Fellow at the University of Minnesota. So in our conversation today, you will be hearing about John's innovative journey that has led to his historical Ramsey County attorney position in 2011. Congratulations, John, and welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on. That bio was way too long. When you read it, it goes so long. So I'm kind of a humble guy, so I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm thinking, oh, I hope she'll stop soon. But that's what's on our website, so...
Well, and you're very accomplished.
And
it's not easy to, I guess, work your way as a first generation person, setting national records.
Yeah, I think I'm very lucky, and I had some great parents, people who love me, and that's the greatest blessing that I have, and many people in our community have, but there's a lot of other people who don't have that, and I think those are the things that if I could change, if I had a magic wand, that all young people would have, caring parents and a family that would be there for them. But there's so many kids growing up in our community today that don't have that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of, I think, what's really impressive about your background, too, is how you're addressing kind of sexual assault and just building our communities up in an area that hasn't gotten enough attention, but is now.
Well, when we think about some of those issues associated with sexual assaults, child sex abuse, all of those things, those are things that culturally, first of all, we have a difficult time coming to terms with, understanding the prevalence of it, talking about it and better addressing it, because it's one of those things that's underground in many ways, and I think one of the best things today about some of the things that are happening with respect to the Me Too movement is that I feel for the first time that more and more people who have been victimized are feeling some sense of support in which they can actually talk about what has happened to them. In the context of clergy sex abuse, if you think about some of those victims and what had happened to them when they were young children, those young kids at the age of whatever age they were, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, if they told their mom and dad, oftentimes what would happen is that parents may not have believed them,
right?
Or they might have minimized it or might have been really embarrassed by that and somehow believed it was maybe their own fault or their child's fault. And I think in many ways we're starting to evolve. I mean, society rarely, it's not like a revolution. It's more like a slow evolution. And I feel like we're at a really important moment right now.
Yeah.
Where there's just more capacity in our communities to better address this. And we're learning so much more about kind of how victims are going to be hurt by all this, the trauma that they're going to experience. And we better understand kind of how things will play out for them. And by knowing that, I think in many ways we are slowly becoming better at trying to respond to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Oprah Winfrey had a show where she had filled the audience with men who had been sexually abused. And they were each holding a picture, which I will never forget, of an image of the age that they were at when they were abused.
Yeah.
And what she had said was people think it's about sex.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if lots of people are having sex, what's the big deal?
Yeah, right.
But it's such a power and control.
It's all about power and control and entitlement.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Entitlement.
Right.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, if you think about kind of how sex trafficking, how has it happened that 16-year-old girls were run away from home, get trafficked? Well, there's a marketplace, so it starts with a demand, right?
Yeah.
And so boys grow up to be men in our community who feel entitled just to purchase sex, right? Or they, you know, we're learning a lot about the things that are coming out about the Me Too movement. Powerful men feel entitled because of their position and their power to take advantage of that and maybe grab somebody's buttocks or, you know, say things that they would never say in front of their spouse or their mother. Those types of things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is astonishing. And with regarding the Pennsylvania grand jury report, in Minnesota, there's an unfolding number of bankruptcies that are amid abuse lawsuits in four different archdioceses.
Right.
St. Cloud, Duluth, Winona, and Crookston.
Right.
Now, do you want to describe? I'm coming at this from. Mm-hmm. We'll start with where we're at, and then I'd like to know more about your background too, because I think
wherever you want to take it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So you just ask those questions, and I'll we can unpack it all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds great. So, can you tell us a little bit about how you have been involved
yeah.
with prosecuting?
So this was a really big part of my second term. So I will just be starting my third term come here in January. But a big part of my second term, thank you, was dealing with this issue of clergy sex abuse. And for me, it began in the fall of 2013. Minnesota Public Radio, and I think our public should give credit to them for their investment that they made into reporting clergy sex abuse, because they had been working on this for quite some time before their first story came out in 2013. And of course, their story happened in many ways because there was a very courageous woman by the name of Jennifer Hasselberger, who was essentially a whistleblower and reported some of the things that were happening in the chancery in the Minneapolis and St. Paul archdiocese that nobody probably would have ever known about it but for her coming forward with some of that information. But it began for me in 2013 when the first media report came out about some of these issues, and specifically it involved a particular priest at that time. His name was Father Curtis Wehmeyer. He's no longer a priest. He's been defrocked by the Catholic Church. But at that time, there were some allegations that were surfaced as a part of the reporting on Minnesota Public Radio that the Archdiocese kind of had mishandled that, and they were trying to maybe cover up some of these things that were occurring, right? And so as a result of that, that certainly got my attention and the attention of our police chief at that time, which was Tom Smith, and also the community, because we were shocked. Because in many ways, I think the entire community of Minneapolis and St. Paul and the surrounding suburbs that would include that archdiocese, we were led to believe that in 2002, when they had this huge effort around the Dallas Charter, and Archbishop Flynn at that time was kind of was in the leadership role of kind of putting all of that together, that things were taken care of, right? And our surprise,
yeah.
It wasn't. So that's when, but in terms of how you put together an investigation, you know, what both Chief Smith and I decided would be the most appropriate way to do it would be for us to call out for victims to come forward, because, you know, we can't start a law enforcement investigation without victims, right?
Yeah.
So people have to tell us what happened. And so obviously we had interviewed Jennifer Hasselberger already, but we needed some people to come forward and tell us about some of their issues. And so a number of people did. And so many of those situations, of those victims that did come forward, you know, there was one gentleman who I think was in his late 30s who came forward. It was the first time that he had ever told anybody. He hadn't told his wife, hadn't told his mom and dad, and he just kept that secret, you know, that whole time. But because of just some of the reporting and the news coverage, he felt compelled that he should tell the police what had happened to them. But when he spoke with that investigator, it was the first time that he ever told his story. Now, for many of those situations in which victims came forward, we were not able to prosecute because the statute of limitations, you know, had expired. Because we've had a long history in Minnesota of our statutes of limitations around child sex abuse. But if you look at the history of it, you could see this evolution, you know.
Oh, sure.
So today, you know, the statute of limitations is really almost forever. I mean, in the context that it's 3 years from the time that you actually tell the police, right? So we recognize today that if you're, you know, 40 years old and, well, it depends on when the law, you know, it's only on or after a certain date when the new statute of limitations was created. So for anybody in the future, right, who recognizes their child sex abuse and wants to report it, it starts when you report it to the police. So you have 3 years to do that. But back long, long time ago, the statute of limitations would run maybe 3 years after the incident.
I see.
Right. And yeah. So we've had an evolution in that. But many of those victims that came forward were under the old statutes of limitations. And just for your listeners, so that they understand what that means, is that it's in every state in America, we have a very bedrock principle of criminal justice, is that you can't be prosecuted for something that's too old, right? So there's a time limitation upon which something can be considered for criminal prosecution.
Sure.
And so typically that could be, you know, 3 years or 6 years or 9 years, depending on what kind of violation you're talking about. Obviously, for homicide, there is no statute of limitations. And for today, for like child sex abuse, it would be 3 years from the time that you report. So that really means in many ways there really isn't a statute of limitations today.
Yeah, which is really important.
It is, right.
Because it's the recovery from
right.
it and just recognizing what
yeah.
has happened
yeah.
and how it's affected your life.
Right.
Takes
but
a lot
there
to
was
come
a
to terms
great
with.
Importance mm-hmm. with all of those victims courageously coming forward and telling their stories, even though despite the fact that we were unable to bring criminal charges for them, one thing became very clear was that based upon the information that we were receiving and the information that we were getting by looking at the church files, clearly there was this theme of that the institution,
playbook.
Right,
yes.
The institution would put routinely their interests or the interests of the offending priest above the interests of the sexually abused child. And there would be ways in which the church would deal with those situations, right? And so that theme, as more information was coming forward, I would say we wanted to make it very clear in January that, you know, we were getting a lot of pressure from media. One particular, I mean, I'm not casting dispersion or criticism for Minnesota Public Radio, but I think they really did come to the conclusion that they thought that the church should be prosecuted for violating the mandatory reporter law, you know, which is that within 24 hours of getting an incident of an allegation of child sex abuse, whether it's physical or sexual abuse, you have to report it to police and or child protection.
Yeah.
That's a law, right? And I think there was some debate about whether or not they had fulfilled that, but I was not interested in prosecuting the church for that particular crime because I believe 10 out of 10 times we would have lost that case because there was information that the public just didn't have at that time of how they would have defended themselves, which, you know, if your attorney tells you that the reporting is tomorrow at 5 o'clock and you rely on that advice, right, it would be a very difficult. I mean, they only missed the deadline. I mean, the worst case scenario, they missed the deadline by like 12 hours, you know. So that's not, and that's a gross misdemeanor offense. And so that wasn't the vehicle by which I thought justice could be achieved. So I wanted to make it clear to get people understanding that that just wasn't going to be. But I made it also very clear that we were going to continue the investigation. And so we started a second phase of the investigation. So we took all of that information that we learned from our very broad reach into review of documents and those particular allegations in instances of clergy sex abuse, and linking that with information that we were able to obtain from Jeff Anderson, who was a private attorney representing many victims.
Yeah.
And additional information that we gathered independently, we were able to put a case together, a criminal prosecution and a civil lawsuit against the Archdiocese of St. Paul of Minneapolis, alleging that they had violated two statutes, that they had contributed to the needs of children needing services and protection.
Yeah.
And we also allege that they had contributed to children being delinquent, meaning that it's not that we have to prove that the child was actually violating any laws, but just proving that they were doing things, putting children in jeopardy. So we brought that action in June of, and it took a long time. It was like a 20-some month investigation.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, it really started probably in March or April when I went to the board, and nobody from the media picked that up, so that was great because we wanted to do this in secret because it's important to be able to do this investigation in secret because I didn't want the Archdiocese to know that they were the target of an investigation.
Yeah, so that right. They could get their ducks in a row and,
right.
And
so they
things.
Had no idea. In fact, I remember Archbishop Neinstedt had even gone on TV and they asked him point blank, do you think you're going to be prosecuted? And he said, no, I don't think so. So they probably knew about a month before we filed our criminal charges because I think they kind of figured it out in that context. But by then we had pretty much interviewed everybody that we needed to. Mm-hmm. But the complaint was filed in June of 2015, which was so from going from about March, April, when we went to the board for additional resources,
yeah,
we got an investigator, we got a criminal analyst, and a prosecutor to help us in this effort. And so from, you know, the March, April of 2014 to June of 2015 when the complaint was filed. And then, of course, within 10 days, Archbishop Neinstedt and Auxiliary Bishop Lee Pichet resigned their positions.
Yeah. How come they weren't ever tried?
Well, so we came to a resolution. Now, we chose specifically not to file a complaint against any individual person like the Archbishop or Archbishop Lee Pichet. Father McDonough was also mentioned in that complaint. They were named in the complaint. But we didn't file criminal or civil action against them because we felt that our strongest case, the one that we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt, was against the corporation. So we took action against the corporation because they could not have a defense to say that it wasn't my responsibility, right? Or it was somebody else's responsibility, or I didn't know. If they all had little bits and pieces of information,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they did a pretty good job of trying to silo all of this stuff. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if we put all of our eggs into the basket of trying to prosecute like the Archbishop or something like that, we have to remind ourselves that this is a misdemeanor level offense. So there is going to be no jail time or punishment. It's going to be probation if we were able to get a conviction. And so we felt that we could have more systemic change with respect to targeting the corporation because we felt in the long term, in order for this to never happen again, right?
Yeah.
It would be most important to have the corporation in jeopardy. And then, of course, the civil lawsuit gave us additional powers. And today, still to this day, and up till February of 2021, the Catholic Church in the Twin Cities is under our supervision and the court's jurisdiction. So every 6 months, you know, as a part of the settlement agreement, it was a landmark settlement agreement that we reached in December of 2015, and then we amended it in July of 2016. But that the provisions in there are things that are, you know, never were done before in the country.
So how you approached setting up this case and the yeah. direction that you went is, it sounds to me like it's a longer term view.
Well, I said we the goals, as I recall them, I mean, it's all part of the public record. I mean, you know, we had a big press conference and we had a press release, but I believe that the three goals that we had said is that we wanted to have accountability. We wanted to find justice for the victims. And number three, we wanted to make sure that this never happened again.
And just from your own personal experience, that mm-hmm. last one, mm-hmm. like it would never happen again. Did you yeah. really believe that no abuse would ever happen again?
Well, it's not going to happen as long as we're involved up until February of 2021. I can assure you of that. But after that, it'll be up to the Catholic Church and how, but we've structured the settlement because my view about making sure that this never happens again in the Catholic Church involves, I guess, you know, it's not the government. I mean, we're kind of forcing them in some ways, I guess, through the settlement agreement today. But I hope deep culturally it will change where we have to address the issue of clericalism. And clericalism is this thought or custom or way of thinking that the priests and bishops, that they are kind of, that we are deferential to whatever they say and their interests come first, right?
Yeah.
And in many ways, that's kind of baked into canon law, you know, the way that the Catholic Church runs itself.
Right. Yeah.
That's very deep-seated. But it's also grounded in, I guess, you know, the Catholic theology of forgiveness and, you know, all of those things. And so there's this conflict about how they view the world versus our secular world. You know, I mean, any organization. I mean, Nancy, if you and I were business partners and we had 100 employees and one of our employees was alleged to have abused children, we'd fire them. Like tomorrow.
Right. Yeah.
We'd call them in the office and say, pack your stuff and go and you're gone. We don't want anybody associated with our company that would abuse children, right?
Yeah.
But the Catholic Church is different. They're you know, they're an organization but they have to follow the secular laws, right? The civil authorities laws. And so in order for that to change, they have to recognize that when they take advantage of our secular laws, like the ability to incorporate, right?
Yeah.
That they have to follow those laws and customs and mores and practices. That's our community's expectation. And so the only way that that can happen, in my opinion, is ensuring that there are lay voices, meaning non-clerics, as a part of the decision-making in the Catholic Church at the local level. And not having all of the power with the Archbishop, especially on this topic.
Well,
because before, what was happening
yeah.
is the Archbishop had all the power and the control, and what they had as it related to some form of review board, really, they never even hardly met. And a lot of these instances, you know, never went before the review board. And then, of course, the person who was staffing all of this was also a priest.
Right.
Right. And so our action put in jeopardy the corporation, the lay members that were on the board of directors, their reputations. They're very powerful people, you know, who are in this community, who are on that board of directors, and to demand that they have more lay involvement in their review process, and they don't have a cleric or a priest doing the work for the archbishop. And so I think that's a big fundamental underpinning of what we believe to ensure, because we're not going to be able to change canon law, and I can't change who the Pope is or what the Pope does, right? But we can certainly demand, at least in the terms, in the context of this settlement agreement, and in the context of how the church operates for now until February of 2021, that we're expecting that they're going to have lay involvement. Hopefully that culture change, right? And I believe that this current archbishop, Archbishop Hebda, is embracing that. And so, so my hope is that even beyond the settlement agreement that they would be able to continue doing that.
Okay. We're close to running out of time,
yeah.
But the conundrum that I have mm-hmm. is in reading the Pennsylvania grand jury report, mm-hmm. I mean, it was covered 70 years,
right.
And there are seven strategies
right.
that are in play, not mm-hmm. just in those six archdioceses,
yeah.
but they're in play in every archdiocese
correct.
Around the world.
Right.
Which means they're not likely to report to the police. That's
yeah.
their last
right.
route, although mm-hmm. they are now. But
well, not
I don't know.
All I can tell, well, all I can assure the public is that in my archdiocese here in Ramsey County, the Twin Cities Archdiocese, they are doing that.
Okay. All right. Well, mm-hmm. it's from a layperson's perspective. And from a leadership perspective, mm-hmm. it's just horrifying.
Yeah, it is.
That if this playbook is in play,
right.
that the whole Catholic Church isn't shut down as a result of it,
mm-hmm.
At least in mm-hmm. the United States.
Yeah.
Why isn't that happening?
Why isn't the Catholic Church being shut down? Well, I mean, as a part of some prosecution, maybe it will be. I don't know. You know, I mean, depending on what laws might be violated, you know, a corporation could be dissolved.
Okay.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Because I just think that, you know, they all grew up in mm-hmm. All the priests grew up in the same system. And it's a very, very corrupt way of living a life.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's compromised.
In the context of how they handled clergy sex abuse,
yeah,
I would agree with you.
Yeah, and so I don't know how, you know, there's so many victims. I mean, it's just incredible
mm-hmm.
how far down the pipe this has to go in order to get
right.
some...
Right, I mean, why does it have to require a prosecutor to bring criminal charges in a civil action? I mean, this should be... it should be common sense or just the right thing to do, you know, to not have these problems. And the way you do that, quite
well,
simply,
these are priests at the pulpit telling us how, you know,
yeah.
what to believe.
Right. Well, that's clericalism.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a challenge between our legal system and what's going on there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this conversation has gone fast. I
yeah.
really appreciate the insights into how the civil lawsuits work and your work in kind of moving the work that Jennifer Hasselberger
right.
had started,
right.
Moved it forward and having a longer view
mm-hmm.
So that you were doing what you can within the legal system
right.
to kind of set a foundation for future lawsuits.
Right, and then also justice isn't just in the criminal justice system. It's also in the civil justice system. And there have been numerous civil attorneys who have filed lawsuits on behalf of victims. And Jeff Anderson would be one of them. And he's been, you know, representing clients and victims throughout the country. And a big part of the reason why many of these archdioceses are filing for bankruptcy protection is because of these lawsuits. I mean, there was a time, long, long time ago, people probably thought Jeff Anderson was crazy. Today, many people would view him to be, you know, heroic.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay, terrific. Well, thank you for taking the time for this conversation.
Great.
I really appreciate you. And I was wondering if we could have a little bit of a shorter conversation, but also mm-hmm. I would like to talk about your background.
Sure, absolutely.
And how you've gotten to where you're at.
Yeah.
I think it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Great. All right. Thanks. Thanks for tuning in. And Bob Cabea is behind the scenes here as sound technician and photographer. So thanks, Bob, for being here, filling in for your dad. Okay. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Do you want to promote your business and grow in your leadership skills? Here are a few ways you can promote your business and get leadership help through We Mentor, Inc. You can be a podcast guest. Challenge yourself to share who you are on air. We'll help you out. Secondly, you can sponsor our podcast program. You can invest a small fee to have you and your company name announced at the beginning and end of one or more shows. The third way that you can promote your business and grow in your leadership skills is you can set up an individual strategy session to do work one-on-one with me, focusing on specific life and leadership issues and skills you want to acquire. Or the fourth way is you can join an entrepreneurial leadership and mentoring lab. These ELM labs start throughout the year. They are small groups of 5 to 9 business owners who are out to profoundly shift their lives and lead with authenticity. In 2016, I became a registered yoga instructor and mindfulness meditation teacher. I also became certified online with Brené Brown's Brave Leadership and Courage Works courses to learn an effective process of being all in, falling, getting up, and trying again. In turn, I can mentor others in how to dare greatly and rise strong. I feel better equipped to help you forge ahead in these times of great uncertainty. Our Entrepreneurial Leadership and Mentoring Lab process is an integrated approach to leadership development. We do yoga, meditation, and leadership revolution skill setting. Yes, we will help you learn how to strengthen your body, strengthen your mind, and increase your emotional stamina as part of our leadership development process, along with learning about real-world business planning and strategic planning. We do what works. Get involved, get started. You can reach me at 612-804-8920 or go to wementor.com and connect with us. Lastly, if you like our podcast program, help us keep it going. You can donate to our program. Just go to the wementor.com website, click on Buy button, and fill in the donation amount that you would like to contribute. We appreciate any and all contributions. See you next week.